Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. And here are today's business headlines. OPEC signals cautious optimism on trade, holds oil demand forecast. Sony Group projects lower annual profit due to U.S. tariffs. Energy and utilities roundup, market talk. Basic materials roundup, market talk. Tencent posts solid results as AI investments start to pay off. Tech, media, and telecom roundup, market talk. Woodside suggests Armco could join Louisiana and LNG project. Shell faces fresh legal challenge over development of new oil and gas fields. NRG buys 18 natural gas power plants in bet on soaring energy demand. Energy utilities roundup, market talk. Elliott eyes bet on pipeline carrying Russian gas. Telefonica swings to net loss after sale of Latin America operations. Foxconn posts strong profit but lowers guidance amid tariff risks. Imperial Brands shares fall on CEO retirement. Compass Group backs full-year guidance as earnings rise. Hapag-Lloyd confirms guidance but warns on uncertainty. Our first article today is OPEC signals cautious optimism on trade, holds oil demand forecast. The cartel still expects oil demand to rise by 1.3 million barrels a day this year and 1.28 million barrels a day the next, by Giulia Petroni. The organization of the OPEC. Sony Group projects lower annual profit due to U.S. tariffs. The Japanese electronics and entertainment company said it expects U.S. tariffs to lower operating profit by 100 billion yen, equivalent to $678.1 million, by Kosaku Narioka. Sony Group reported higher quarterly earnings, supported by its music and movie businesses, but said it expects to drop in net profit for the current fiscal year due partly to the impact of U.S. tariffs. The Japanese electronics and entertainment company on Wednesday said it expects U.S. tariffs to lower operating profit by 100 billion yen, equivalent to $678 million for the year that began in April. Sony didn't factor in the reduced tariffs on China announced earlier this week. Chief Financial Officer Lin Tao said U.S. tariffs would affect its game, entertainment, electronics, and image sensor businesses. The projection took into account the various measures the company would need to take, such as price increases and changes in shipping locations, she said. Tao said the company has been diversifying its production sites for the playback station 5 and building inventory in the U.S. to deal with tariffs. She said the PlayStation and related products are produced mainly in 4 countries, including China. Tao said the company expects to ship 15 million PlayStation 5s this fiscal year. That is fewer than the 18.5 million units sold in the previous year. Chief Executive Hiroki Totoki acknowledged that producing hardware like game consoles locally could help address tariffs. However, since Sony makes the PlayStation 5 in several sites, whether or not it will manufacture them in the U.S. isn't an urgent matter, he said. That is something the company can consider going forward, he added. Besides that, the company is also closely watching developments around potential U.S. tariffs on movies produced abroad, Totoki said. The cautious outlook comes as Sony has spent billions on acquisitions to boost its entertainment content. The company bought U.S. video game maker Bungle in 2022, an anime-focused U.S. streaming service, Crunchyroll, in 2021. In January, Sony acquired an additional stake in major Japanese publishing house Kadokawa for more than $300 million. It said it would explore initiatives such as making live-action films and television dramas using intellectual property from Kadokawa. Sony said Wednesday that net profit rose 4.6% from a year earlier to 179.73 billion yen for the 3 months ended March. That beat the estimate of 153.5 billion yen in a poll of analysts by data provider Visible Alpha. Investors cheered the results, sending Sony's shares 3.7% higher in Tokyo. The company also said it will buy back up to 250 billion yen of its shares over the next year. For the year that began in April, it projected net profit to fall 13% to 930 billion yen and revenue to decline 2.9% to 11.7 hundred trillion yen. Fourth quarter revenue dropped 24% to 2.63 trillion yen. Operating profit increased for its music and movie businesses but fell for its game business. Sony's stock has traded higher over the past year, driven by hopes for success as it focuses on its game and entertainment businesses. Fears about U.S. tariffs have weighed on sentiment recently. Rival video game maker Nintendo forecast higher annual profits last week, counting on a boost from sales of the long-awaited Switch 2 console, which is set to hit the market next month. It expects to sell 15.0 million Switch 2s this fiscal year. Write to Kosaku Narioka at kosaku.narioka@wsj.com. Woodside suggests Armaco could join Louisiana LNG project. Opportunities include Armaco's potential acquisition of an equity interest in Louisiana LNG and supply of liquefied natural gas from the $17.5 billion project by David Winning. Sydney Energy floated the possibility of Saudi Arabian oil company known as Armaco buying a stake in its newly approved Louisiana LNG project after signaling a collaboration agreement with the giant producer. Woodside said the non-binding agreement with Aramco, signed in Riyadh at the Saudi-U.S. Investment Forum, paves the way for both companies to explore global opportunities. It said those opportunities include Aramco's potential acquisition of an equity interest in Louisiana LNG and supply of liquefied natural gas from the $17.5 billion project. Woodside, late last month, made the decision to build Louisiana LNG, targeting first production of LNG in 2029. Louisiana's LNG's initial phase involves construction of three units able to produce up to 16.5 million metric tons of LNG annually, although Woodside holds permits to produce as much as 26.6 million tons of LNG a year. The company recently agreed to sell 40% interest in the entity that owns infrastructure supporting Louisiana LNG to Stonepeak for $5.7 billion. Chief Executive Meg O'Neill said on April 29th that Woodside has involved in intensive discussions with a couple of parties interested in participating in Louisiana LNG without identifying them. Write to David Winning at david.winning@wsj.com. Shell faces fresh legal challenges over development of new oil and gas fields. Dutch environmental group Milieudefensie said by developing new fields, the oil and gas giant is in breach of legal duties to cut carbon emissions, by Yusuf Khan. Dutch energy giant Shell is facing a fresh legal challenge over its role in contributing to climate change from activists seeking to halt new developments of oil and gas projects by the company. In a statement of its intent to start legal proceedings, The Dutch arm of environmental group Friends of the Earth, Milieu Defensie, said Shell was in breach of its legal duty of care under Dutch law due to its continued investment in new oil and gas fields and its inadequate climate policy for the period of 2030 to 2050. The move follows a ruling in November last year in an appeal brought by Shell against a 2021 landmark decision which found the Dutch energy giant was partially responsible for climate change and must sharply cut carbon emissions. The appeal ruling found Shell is obliged to reduce its emissions, but the court was unable to determine by what percentage it should do so. The November ruling was seen as a win for Shell. On Tuesday, based on the appeal ruling, Milieu Defensie said that by developing new oil and gas fields, Shell was in breach of its legal duties. There is no doubt that the climate problem is the greatest issue of our time. The Court of Appeal is of the opinion that companies like Shell, which contribute significantly to the climate problem and have it within their power to contribute to combating it, have an obligation to limit CO2 emissions in order to counter dangerous climate change. The Court of Appeals said in November, on which Milieu Defensie is basing its case. We agree urgent action is needed to tackle climate change, a spokesperson for Shell said. The company added that Milieu Defensie's objective won't advance the energy transition, which needs collaboration between governments, businesses, and consumers. The oil and gas giant, in its recent Capital Markets Day, said it was eyeing increased fossil fuel expansion, particularly in the form of liquefied natural gas and oil investments, until at least 2040. Oil and gas companies like Shell and BP have been pushed by investors to stick with their engagement with the fossil fuels over low-carbon technologies in recent months, amid sliding share prices in the sector. A report from Milieu Defensie and Charity Global Witness reported Shell has 700 potential new oil and gas fields in development. Since May 2021, Shell has made final investment decisions to develop 32 new oil and gas assets, which could cause 972 million tons of additional CO2 emissions, Milieu Defensie said in a letter to Shell. The climate crisis is essentially a fossil fuels crisis. Over 80% of CO2 emissions are caused by the production and use of fossil fuels, with over half of those emissions caused by oil and gas, Milieu Defensie said in its letter. Shell and other fossil fuel companies are still actively undermining the clean energy transition by lobbying for and investing in long-term fossil fuel dependence, even though it is of the utmost importance to rapidly transition away from fossil fuels. Legal proceedings are expected to start within 4 weeks, depending on Shell's response, the Dutch non-governmental organization said. Earlier this year, Milieu Defensie launched legal proceedings against Dutch bank ING, saying it wasn't taking strong enough action to tackle climate change by continuing to fund fossil fuel projects. ING said in response that Milieu Defensie's claims were unrealistic and unreasonable, adding it was confident in its climate change approach. We share the concern about the climate, but differ in opinion on what action that requires, it said in a statement. Write to Yusuf Khan at yusuf.khan@wsj.com. China tariff rollback unlikely to boost imports, Port of LA chief says. The executive director of the Port of Los Angeles says he doesn't expect a flood of goods despite the deal reached by the U.S. and China. By Liz Young. The head of one of America's biggest import gateways warned that a deal to slash tariffs on Chinese goods isn't enough to reverse a decline in cargo volume. Volumes at the Port of Los Angeles have been plummeting after companies brought in extra inventory earlier this year to get ahead of new tariffs and have since paused and canceled new orders. That drop in demand has led shipping companies to cancel dozens of sailings at the coming weeks. The port's executive director, Jean Soroka, said he expects imports at the port to end May, down 25% year over year. He said a move to temporarily lower the base tariff rate on Chinese imports to 30% from 145%, announced Monday, is unlikely to lead to a sudden surge in cargo volume. Even at 30%, a tariff with a 90-day reprieve, it's not going to dramatically change what we're seeing right now, Soroka said in an interview Monday with the Wall Street Journal. Soroka said companies that supply critical goods like healthcare products and sellers of holiday merchandise like toys might use this moment to restock. But your refrigerator, outdoor patio set, regular stuff, it's not just going to come and flood the marketplace because we've gone from 145% to 30%, he said. The National Retail Federation said some retailers might find short-term relief in the lowered levies as they stock up for the peak back-to-school and holiday seasons. Some shippers might now rush inventory sitting in China that they had waited to ship into the U.S., under the 30% duty rate, Soroka said. However, I don't see all of the normal cargo coming back to the levels that we had witnessed in recent weeks and months, he said. Reason being, you're not going to be front-loading at 30%. Shipping rates have stayed relatively flat amid the trade turmoil. The average daily spot rate to ship a 40-foot container from Asia to the U.S. West Coast was $2,321 for the week ended May 7th, roughly in line with the previous week, according to the Freightos Baltic Index. Judith Levine, head of research at Freightos, said rates will likely rise but not skyrocket under the 30% base tariff. The volume rebound will probably signal the start of an early peak season that will keep rates elevated, he said. Soroka said he expects spot rates might tick up as carriers shift capacity back to China to U.S. shipping lanes. Write to Liz Young at liz.young@wsj.com. Wall Street is watching this shipping data to gauge tariff impact. Ships, trucks, and railroads are helping measure the economic blow from tariffs by Paul Berger and Gunjan Banajeri. Wall Street is reading the shipping news again, scrambling to gauge how Trump's tariffs are flowing through the global economy. Investors are seeking early signs and data from ports, truckers, and railroads. Traders often turn to shipping and logistics data when the outlook gets murky. Transportation stocks are considered a market bellwether because those companies move the goods and raw materials that power the economy. During the COVID pandemic and the 2008-09 financial crisis, investors tracked moves in an index of shipping costs for commodities such as coal, grain, and fertilizer. U.S. retailers and manufacturers have been stocking up on furniture, clothing, electronics, and everything else that comes into the country by container ship. That has caused a wave of containers to wash over the neighboring ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the main gateway for imports from China. The pull forward indicates that some U.S. businesses have enough inventory to last weeks or longer before having to refresh orders. Southern California port officials expect imports to fall steeply in May. Already, companies have paused bookings for containers that ferry everything from scrunchies to batteries across the oceans. Ryan Peterson, chief executive at Flexport, a San Francisco-based freight forwarder, said China to U.S. bookings have declined 60% since April 9th. Peterson said that for the first time since his company was launched more than a decade ago, Vietnam is a bigger origin point. And ocean carriers have been canceling sailings across the Pacific Ocean to the U.S. almost 30% of such journeys were canceled for the week ended May 4th, according to Flexport, At the Port of Los Angeles, imports are expected to fall 35% this week compared with a year ago. That's going to have a huge impact on the logistics industry, Peterson said. Consumers probably won't see this until later. Truckers are bracing for a tough year by pulling back on orders for big rigs. Net orders for heavy-duty trucks in North America tumbled to 16,500 vehicles in March, down 5.9% from the same month in 2024, with the highest order cancellation rate in almost 2 years, according to ACT Research. Trucking companies had been hoping 2025 would provide a long-awaited turnaround after several years of depressed rates for the sector. Tariffs have injected a new level of uncertainty into forecasts. ACT Research President Ken Veith said dealer inventory levels in March hit a record 91,600 vehicles as truckers were flirting with global financial crisis profitability levels. A measure of the global supply chain hit a five-year low in March. The GEP Global Supply Chain Volatility Index, based on S&P Global's monthly survey of 27,000 businesses in 40 countries, measures factors such as demand for goods, inventory levels, and transportation costs. The March reading was taken as U.S. retailers and manufacturers pull forward orders to stock up ahead of tariffs, but before Trump's sweeping tariff announcements in April. John Piatek, a vice president of consulting at GEP, said the biggest driver of March's decrease was a pullback in manufacturing activity in North America, while companies braced for higher purchasing costs and a possible slowdown in consumer spending. Piatek expects April's reading will show companies cutting back further as they prepare for worse economic conditions. Investors are positioning for more turmoil ahead. The performance this year for the Dow Jones Transportation Average, which tracks shares of shipping, railroad, and logistics companies, is trailing the blue-chip Dow Jones Industrial Average by more than 9 percentage points, one of the worst showings of the past decade. Share prices of big freight companies such as J.B. Hunt Transport Services, Knight-Swift Transportation Holdings, and ocean shipping company Matson have plunged this year. Write to Paul Berger at paul.berger@wsj.com and Gunjan Banerjee at gunjan.banerji@wsj.com. China is building megaports in South America to feed its need for crops. State grain trader COFCO plans world's biggest export terminal in Brazil to substitute U.S. soybeans and other foodstuffs, by Samantha Pearson. Santos, Brazil. China has reassured its citizens that they would have enough to eat without U.S. crops. It will have to unclog Latin America's largest port first. The decrepit port in this Atlantic coast city is the main gateway for South American exports of soybeans and other agricultural goods that represent China's only viable alternative supply to U.S. exports. Though China has reduced its reliance on U.S. foodstuffs, crops are still among the top U.S. exports to China. China's state-owned agricultural conglomerate, COFCO, is building its biggest export terminal outside China at the port to manage shipments of corn, sugar, and soybeans. It would increase the company's annual export capacity to 14 million tons from 4.5 million, but isn't expected to reach full capacity until next year. The Santos port fits into China's wider plan to secure access to South America's agricultural bounty amid shortages of water and arable land at home. Chinese companies are laying hundreds of miles of railroad across Brazil's agricultural heartland and finishing work on $3.5 billion deep water port on Peru's Pacific coast. The trade war with the U.S. has heightened the urgency of these projects. Chinese leader Xi Jinping met South American leaders, including Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in Beijing on Monday, to discuss their deepening ties. Brazilian officials are welcoming the chance to draw foreign investment to the country's rickety roads, railroads, and ports. "We need more and more infrastructure," Renan Filho, Brazil's transportation minister, said in an interview. Squeezed between rows of warehouses and the ruins of colonial-era sugar mills at the heart of the Santos port, a lowering crane was putting the finishing touches to three COFCO silos, each the size of an apartment building. Since entering the Brazilian market in 2014 by acquiring Dutch grain trader Nedera and the agricultural unit of Hong Kong-based Noble, COFCO has relied on third-party terminals at an extra cost of some 15%. But in March of 2022, COFCO secured a 25-year concession to develop the STS-11 terminal at Santos Port, committing to invest some $285 million into the site. China's state ports conglomerate, China Merchants Port Holdings, had already acquired 90% stake in the operator of Paranaguá, another busy port in Brazil's south, in 2017 for $925 million. The state company China Railway has also been building part of a railroad that connects Brazil's central farming belt to ports in eastern and northern Brazil. In Peru, Costco Shipping built a deep water megaport to speed trade between Asia and South America. Beijing has also discussed with the region's governments a vast railroad running from Peru's Pacific coast to Brazilian ports on the Atlantic. Chinese officials in April 28th said they can easily drop U.S. crop imports and still hit their 5% growth target this year. Brazil, and to a lesser extent Argentina, would fill the void, according to analysts tracking agricultural markets. Brazil benefited from global trade tensions during President Trump's first term, displacing U.S. exports to China between 2017 and 2024. China increased imports of Brazilian soybeans 35% to 73 million tons, while cutting imports of U.S. soybeans 14% to 27 million tons, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. "You only have to see what happened in the first Trump administration," said Claudia Trevisan, head of the Brazil-China Business Council. Trump imposed tariffs on imports from China. China retaliated, and Brazil increased its exports to China of products that the U.S. also used to supply, mainly soybeans. In 2023, Brazil accounted for about a quarter of Chinese agricultural imports, while the U.S. share had dropped to about 14%, government data show. Brazil now supplies about 70% of soybean shipments to China. About 30% pass through Santos, with smaller shares sent through Paranaguá and the northern ports of Itaqui and Baracana. Santos can hardly keep up. Santos handled a record of 180 million tons of cargo last year, about 60% of it agricultural goods. Strikes are commonplace. More than 90% of Brazil's port capacity for exporting agricultural bulk goods is in use, exceeding the operational safety limit of 85%, according to logistics consulting from Macro Coinfra. Because the country lacks the extensive railroads that carry soybeans and corn to the U.S., in the U.S., crops mainly arrive in Santos by truck, as many as 20,000 a day. Port authorities say traffic jams snake up to 20 miles down nearby highways. "God knows how anything leaves this country," said Silva Ferreira, a school teacher in Santos, home to almost 500,000 people. Farms are also under pressure, particularly as fertilizer costs soar. Brazil's temperate climate allows for 3 harvests a year, compared with the 1 most countries manage. But this drains the land of nutrients, and Brazil's clay-based soils struggle to retain minerals during heavy rains. So fertilizer is critical. Brazil, which imports 85% of its fertilizers, mainly from Russia, was already struggling to secure what it needed after Russia invaded Ukraine. Trade tensions between the U.S. and Canada, a top fertilizer supplier to its neighbor, have further pushed up global prices. Brazil has so much potential, yes, but it doesn't mean it can wave a magic wand and overnight expand production and meet China's demands, said Plinio Nastari, head of agricultural consulting from Datagro. It has its own problems, and all of this is part of the equation. Write to Samantha Pearson at samantha.pearson@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you, get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Trump slashes de minimis tariffs on small shipments from China. U.S. cuts tax to 54% from 120%, marking another trade de-escalation, by Gareth Vipers and Zhuahai Huang. The Trump administration said it would cut tariffs on low-value parcels from China to 54% from 120%, hours after Washington and Beijing agreed to a 90-day trade truce. According to a White House executive order late Monday, the U.S. will slash the de minimis tariff on shipments from China, including Hong Kong, marking a further de-escalation in the simmering trade war between the world's two largest economies. Under U.S. tax law, the de minimis exemption allows companies to avoid import taxes and customs inspections on international shipments with a retail value of less than $800. President Trump in February suspended the provision for China as part of an executive order imposing tariffs on the nation's imports and imposed a tax of 120% of a package's value. That order caused widespread confusion among e-commerce retailers and logistics operators and prompted the U.S. Postal Service to temporarily stop accepting parcels from China before allowing them again. Trump later delayed the crackdown until Commerce Department could set up a system to process inspections and levies on the shipments. Use of the provision has ballooned in recent years, with a flood of goods from bargain sites such as Shein and Temu. About 1.36 billion shipments using the provision entered the U.S. in fiscal 2024, up from 637 million 4 years earlier, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Earlier Monday, the U.S. and China said they had agreed to suspend most of the tariffs on each other's goods while further trade negotiations continue. The U.S. agreed to lower the base level of tariffs on most Chinese goods to 30% from 145%, while China said it would cut its levies on U.S. products to 10% from 125%. The small parcel tariff will now fall to 54% from Wednesday, the White House said, while a flat fee of $100 will remain but won't rise to $200 in June as previously planned. Tougher trade barriers have led some exporters to raise prices or stop shipping to the U.S. Even with the planned cut, analysts are unclear if there would be much relief for Chinese e-commerce firms that do business in the U.S. And lower tariffs will still affect Shein's and Temu's businesses, as the rate is significantly higher than the previous exemption, said Zhuoping Jing, senior China strategist at ANZ Research. Yet it could offer some breathing room. Many sellers that use de minimis shipments have strong profit margins, said Eurasia Group's China director, Dan Wang. Even with a higher de minimis tariff, a lot of sellers can stay in business, she said. Write to Gareth Vipers at Gareth, G-A-R-E-T-H dot V-I-P-E-R-S at WSJ.com. Temu stops China shipments to U.S. consumers. Chinese bargain site dramatically shifts its business model as tariff exemption ends, by Shen Lu. As the U.S. started applying hefty tariffs on small value packages from China, bargain site Temu said it had stopped shipping products to U.S. consumers directly from the country, marking a dramatic shift in its business model. Ahead of the so-called de minimis exemption for China-made goods on Friday, Boston-based Temu, owned by a Chinese e-commerce giant, PDD Holdings, initially announced that it would raise prices starting last week. It also started breaking out import charges on each individual purchase that often far exceeded the price of the items. In recent days, its website shifted to labeling everything as local, meaning items that had already been imported to the U.S. in bulk and are sitting in U.S. warehouses. Those items are typically more expensive than products that came under the de minimis provision and were shipped directly to consumers. On Friday, Temu confirmed it is no longer shipping goods from China to U.S. consumers. This shift is part of Temu's ongoing adjustments to improve service levels, a Temu spokesperson said in a statement. Use of de minimis has ballooned in recent years with a flood of goods from Temu and its China-founded rival Shane. About 1.36 billion shipments using the provision entered the U.S. in fiscal year 2024, up from 637 million 4 years earlier, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. In April, President Trump ordered an end to the exemption for goods made in China and Hong Kong by May 2nd. The elimination of the exemption for China imports also means a heavier documentation burden at customs for e-commerce companies that could be disruptive to businesses. Temu had prepared for the end of de minimis. A year ago, it started recruiting U.S.-based sellers who were importing their own inventory from China, competing directly with Amazon.com and Walmart. Temu's representatives told sellers they could benefit from joining what Temu calls the local-to-local programs. More than 30% of its sales were handled by U.S.-based sellers, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Temu's products were 20% to 30% cheaper than U.S. competitors like Amazon. The bargain site is losing much of its price advantage with the full shift to local fulfillment, and it is unclear how long supplies already in the U.S. will last. They removed the scary import charge shock, but now there is less stuff to buy. Most of the best sellers were from China, says Joachim Konzukas, an independent e-commerce analyst. The best sellers on Temu are mostly bulky furniture and household appliances, replacing the ultra-cheap smaller items Temu is known for, such as hairpins and charging cables. In the short term, Temu is likely to unload the inventory in China intended for the U.S. market to other countries, which threatens to cut into their already razor-thin margin, said Martin Balam, chief executive of Pimberly, an AI-powered product platform for e-commerce. In the medium term, Temu, like other businesses that rely heavily on manufacturing in China, faces business uncertainty while hoping for policy reversals. If no such reversals come, Temu will have to adjust its business model and manufacturing capacity, but it will set them back, Balam said. Write to Shen Lu at Shen, S-H-E-N.L-U at WSJ.com. U.S. trade deficit hits record as companies front-load pharmaceuticals. Businesses rushed to stockpile before Liberation Day tariffs took effect last month, by Chao Deng and Anthony DeBarros. The U.S. trade deficit ballooned 14% to a record $140.5 billion in March as businesses stockpile goods to get ahead of sweeping tariffs that President Trump imposed the following month. The value of imported goods totaled $346.8 billion, according to Census Bureau data, and continuing a sharp increase that began January. Nearly all of the $22.5 billion surge in imported consumer goods for March were pharmaceutical products, which the Trump administration is currently considering to hit with tariffs. Imports of computer accessories, automobiles, and car parts and engines also increased. The rush may be short-lived. Trump announced tariffs on imported goods on April 2nd and ratcheted up his trade war with China. Cargo shipments from China have slowed considerably, with additional tariffs on Chinese goods now pegged at 145%. The record has only been a result of front-running, and the trade deficit should be narrower in April, said Bradley Saunders, economist at Capital Economics. Some economists say businesses continued to front-load in April as Trump put a 90-day pause on reciprocal tariffs or the higher duties for some countries. The concentration on pharmaceuticals also means companies don't buy as much of everything else, from toys to apparel. Omar Sharif, an economist at the advisory firm Inflation Insights, LLC, said as the Trump administration takes time to possibly reach trade deals with other nations, businesses might begin to run down on stockpiles of inventory. For American consumers, he said, it meant store shelves may be emptier sooner than we thought. The sharp rise in the goods deficit to a record of $163.5 billion was offset by a $23 billion surplus in services trade, which includes travel, transportation, and financial services. The U.S. exported about $95 billion in services in March. The March report capped off a quarter that saw the U.S. import $3 trillion worth of goods, up from $796 billion during the same period last year. Meanwhile, exports of U.S. goods have only risen modestly, reaching $539 billion in the first quarter. That imbalance pushed the goods deficit to $466 billion for the quarter, up from $279 billion a year ago. During the quarter, the U.S. imported $51 billion more in goods from Switzerland than it did during the same period a year earlier, much of that in gold, according to census data. The precious metal, often recast in Swiss refineries, is viewed as a haven in times of heightened risk. A surge of U.S. imports during the quarter also came from Ireland, Mexico, Taiwan, and Vietnam. Trade data for April is due for release in early June. Write to Chow Deng at chow.deng@wsj.com and Anthony DeBarros at anthony.debarros, D-E-B-A-R-R-O-S, at wsj.com. China swings to goods trade deficit, surplus with U.S. narrows. The value of exports in February dropped 5.5% compared with January to $70 billion Canadian dollars, including a 33.6% fall in shipments to the U.S. by Rob M. Stewart. Ottawa. Canadian exports of a wide range of products pulled back sharply in February, narrowing the country's trade surplus with the U.S., offering a sign of the volatility that can be expected as the Trump administration wields tariffs against even longtime allies. Canada unexpectedly swung to a merchandise trade deficit for the month of $1.52 billion Canadian dollars, the equivalent of about $1.07 billion American dollars, Swiss, U.S. dollars. Statistics Canada said Thursday that was the first deficit in 3 months and the largest since August, following January's downwardly revised $3.13 billion Canadian dollar surplus. Economists were expecting Canada to log a surplus of about $3.5 billion Canadian dollars in February, though forecasts hold a degree of uncertainty given President Trump's continuously changing tariff threats. The value exports dropped 5.5% compared with January, including a 3.6% fall in shipments to the U.S. after reaching a fresh record a month earlier. The retreat came after overall exports jumped almost 16% between September and January, in part due to American companies building inventories in anticipation of U.S. tariffs on imports. Imports into Canada nudged up 0.8% for the month, but were flat in volume terms, while imports from across Canada's southern border jumped 2.5%. The movement narrowed Canada's long-running goods trade surplus with the U.S. to 10.57 billion Canadian dollars from January's record of 13.74 billion. Economists anticipate demand for Canadian goods from the biggest buyer by far, the U.S., will be dented by the growing trade dispute between the countries, and after Trump on Wednesday widened his net with the sweeping tariffs on imports from around the world, that in turn will weigh on Canada's economy, which showed signs of stalling in February after a strong start to the year. Uncertainty around tariffs and the broader outlook for trade surely weighed on activity in February, and that's likely to worsen in March and April, said Benjamin Reitzes, a managing director and Canadian rates and microeconomic strategist at Bank of Montreal. While the value of Canadian exports plunged in February, it was still relatively solid and only slightly below where it stood in December. Still, for economists, it does suggest the tariff front-running by U.S. importers that was seen in recent months has reversed sharply. Catherine Judge, a senior economist at CIBC Capital Markets, said that there are signs U.S. businesses have accumulated enough inventory of late to keep Canadian exports under pressure in March, added to which has been the White House's introduction of tariffs on a large portion of goods from Canada and levies on specific sectors like autos and metals that are critical to Canada's economy. The retreat in Canada's exports from February was broad in terms of both goods and destination. Shipments to countries other than the U.S. sank 12.4% for the month, widening the trade deficit with non-U.S. nations to a record $12 billion Canadian dollars. Shipments of energy products saw the largest decline, the first decrease since September, with a fall in exports of crude oil, natural gas, refined petroleum products, and coal. Energy is Canada's top export by far, with most of that heading to the U.S. Excluding energy products, total exports were down 5.3% in February. Exports of motor vehicles and parts also drops sharply after reaching their highest level since 2000 in January. Canada's auto manufacturing industry is deeply integrated with the U.S., and some 93% of exports of passenger cars and light trucks in 2024 headed across the border on a customs basis. Exports of metal and non-metallic mineral products fell following four consecutive months of increases, and shipments of forestry products and building and packaging materials also were down after 3 months in a row of increases. Metals and mineral products are among the most valuable exports to the U.S., and most of Canada's lumber exports are destined for the U.S. In early March, the White House imposed 25% tariffs on many goods imported from Canada and Mexico after postponing the move for 30 days. A 25% levy on all imports of steel and aluminum, much of which comes from Canada, kicked in on March 12th, and a 25% tariff on global automobile imports came into effect Thursday. Canada and Mexico escaped Wednesday's round of sweeping tariffs aimed at countries around the world, though the president has signaled he plans to impose levies on specific sectors such as lumber. Today's data are a sobering reminder of the impact the U.S. tariffs will have on the economy, said Bradley Saunders, North American economist at Capital Economics. The figures also add weight to Statistics Canada's advance estimate last week that industry-level gross domestic product was flat in February, following stronger-than-expected growth of 0.4% on month in January and a solid expansion in the final quarter of 2024. When Canada's international trade in goods and international trade in services were combined, Canadian exports fell 4.8%, while imports rose 0.4%. As a result, Canada's trade incorporating both goods and services shifted to a $2.21 billion Canadian dollar surplus from a $2.57 billion surplus a month earlier. Write to Rob M. Stewart at rob.stewart@wsj.com. And now for an opinion article. Trump isn't the first president Putin has played. Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Biden all tried to appease the Russian leader and were manipulated, by Tom Rogan. Donald Trump says he wants peace in Ukraine. The problem is that Mr. Trump sees Vladimir Putin for who he wishes Mr. Putin to be, a hardened but practical interlocutor, rather than for who he is, a former KGB lieutenant colonel who revels in the dark art of ruthless manipulation. Mr. Trump was shaped by the wheeler-dealer New York City real estate scene. Mr. Putin was shaped by the brutal maximalism of the KGB's Red Banner Institute. But Mr. Trump isn't the first U.S. president to take an unrealistic view of his Russian counterpart. Consider his predecessor's experiences. The first American president to deal with Mr. Putin, Bill Clinton, chose to remain largely silent on human rights concerns in Russia, including Mr. Putin's wanton disregard for civilian casualties during the Second Chechen War. Mr. Clinton instead focused on wooing Mr. Putin to join the post-Cold War democratic international order. Mr. Putin did nothing of the sort. He intimidated the Russian media, cultivated an inner circle of oligarchs who traded vast wealth for political loyalty, and embedded politically vested corruption into the Russian economy, all while Mr. Clinton stood idly by. Next came George W. Bush, meeting Mr. Putin in June 2001. Mr. Bush said he looked the man in the eye and found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy, adding that he gained a sense of his soul. Mr. Bush had been duped by Mr. Putin's KGB mind games. Mr. Putin appealed to Mr. Bush, a born-again Christian, with a story about his mother's Orthodox cross being rescued from a fire in her dacha. Mr. Putin adopted a similar tactic with Mr. Trump's chief foreign affairs negotiator, Steve Witkoff, telling Mr. Witkoff that he had prayed for Mr. Trump when he learned of the assassination attempt against him last July. Mr. Putin was never the pro-modernization leader Mr. Bush hoped he might be. By the end of the Bush presidency, Mr. Putin had launched a vicious cyber attack on North Atlantic Treaty Organization member Estonia, heavily supported Iran's nuclear program, and invaded Georgia. Then there was Barack Obama. Soon after taking office in 2009, Mr. Obama essentially excused Russia's invasion of Georgia 5 months prior, publicly seeking a reset in relations. That July, Mr. Obama traveled to Moscow to meet with Mr. Putin. Obama advisor Michael McFaul, who served as ambassador to Russia from 2012 through 2014, recounts in his 2018 book how Mr. Putin quickly asserted dominance over the American president. Putin spoke uninterrupted for nearly the entire time scheduled for the meeting, documenting the injustices of the Bush administration. This was a guy with a chip on his shoulder. Obama listened patiently, maybe too patiently. It was my assignment to read out this meeting to our press corps later that day. I couldn't tell them that Obama had merely listened the entire time. Mr. Putin reveled in Mr. Obama's policy of appeasement. Beginning around 2008, Russia persistently breached the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The U.S. didn't withdraw from the treaty until 2019 under Mr. Trump. In 2016, members of Russia's Federal Security Service attacked and harassed U.S. diplomats and intelligence officers in Moscow. During the intervening years, Russia seized Crimea and southeastern Ukraine, militarily intervened to save Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad from defeat in his country's civil war, and downed a civilian passenger plane flying over eastern Ukraine. Mr. Obama was so fearful of standing against Mr. Putin's aggression that he refused to provide Ukraine with lethal military support. Even when Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee and leaked its emails during the 2016 presidential campaign, all Mr. Obama did was unsuccessfully request that Mr. Putin cut it out. Finally, there was Joe Biden. In June 2021, Mr. Biden met with Mr. Putin in Geneva. At the end of the summer, Mr. Biden said, "All foreign policy is logical extension of personal relationships. It's the way human nature functions." The tone of the entire meeting was good. Positive, Mr. Putin invaded Ukraine 8 months later. Mr. Biden helped facilitate robust international sanctions on Russia after the invasion, but he repeatedly hesitated before providing Ukraine with anti-tank weapons, long-range artillery rockets, and F-16 fighter jets. He also limited the paths that U.S. drones could take over the Black Sea to avoid confrontations with Russia. By contrast, even after Russia fired a missile near a British spy plane in 2022, Britain continued to send planes into the region with fighter escorts. Mr. Biden gave too much credence to Mr. Putin's nuclear threats and didn't do enough to help Ukraine defend itself. Mr. Trump may be doing even worse in this regard, though he has returned manned U.S. spy planes to the Black Sea, but Mr. Biden set the tone for excessive deference towards Mr. Putin's rhetoric. Perhaps the best example of the consequences of tolerating Mr. Putin's manipulation games comes not from the American president, but from Britain's Tony Blair. During the 2001 trip to Moscow that included celebration of Mr. Putin's birthday, Prime Minister Blair said, "From my very first meeting, I recognized that President Putin is a man who had the imagination and courage to set relations on a new course. In return, Mr. Putin had its oligarchs buy up assets in London and use this financial power to influence the media, intimidate and silence British journalists, and provide political cover for Mr. Putin's nerve agent-wielding assassination squads, who have poisoned several Russian dissidents in Britain." Mr. Trump should consider Mr. Putin's history. The American president may like deals, but Mr. Putin is more cutthroat even than the New York real estate market. Mr. Rogan is a national security writer for the Washington Examiner. That's all the time we have for today for the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you.